Hello, everyone, and welcome to the Inspire Your Life podcast with me, your host, Aarti Ravikrishnan. I believe we find inspiration all around us, especially from the stories that we all have in us. My aim with the Inspire Your Life podcast is to bring some of those real stories to light, stories of my guests that resonate with you and me. It's by listening to these stories that we can be inspired and motivate ourselves to overcome, find a new path, and rise even higher than we thought possible. On the show today is one of the Tasha 10 family members, David McMurtry. David's mission is to innovate the early childhood education, or ECE acronym, industry and improve access to quality ECE for all children through advocacy and legislation in service of stronger communities and societies. Isn't that wonderful, everyone? Having spent more than two decades working with children, David discovered that in order to change the world through education, you actually have to start with the youngest learners. And I absolutely agree with that, actually. So in 2017, he and his wife opened a Goddard preschool in Denver, Colorado, that serves over 200 children from the ages of 6 weeks old to 6 years old. And they grew this into being one of the top 5% most successful Goddard schools in the U.S. based on enrollment and revenue. And in fact, this year, they were awarded the Humanitarian of the Year Award for their dedication to serving that community. That is so, so beautiful, David. Now, everyone, you can tell that David is committed to advocating for and improving ECE across the U.S. He's also a public speaker, a coach, a motivator, and I mean, he's trained tens of thousands across the country with the intention of empowering adults that inspire our youth. But you know what, everyone? Here's the bit that I really love, and I think what's inspired the conversation that David and I are going to have today. So, you know, when David was preparing, he says that his greatest accomplishment in life is his marriage to his beautiful wife, Allison, and that she's the foundation for which all of these goals are possible. And in combination with her passion for ECE, he really feels he has a true partner in making a difference in his community. And together, of course, they're also raising three really, really beautiful kids as well. So that really got me. David, it's such a pleasure to have you on the podcast today. Welcome.
Aarti, thank you so much for having me. This is a pleasure.
Oh, wonderful, wonderful. And I know we've got such a big time difference between us, but we're making this work, which is excellent. David, I've given everyone this sort of bio view of you. But tell us more about you, a little bit more personal things that you'd like to share with, about yourself.
Sure, sure. So you kind of mentioned kind of a history of education, which I don't know exactly how it happened, but that has been my life and my career. Okay. Outside of working at a Mexican restaurant and flipping burgers and college, every job I've had literally since I was 14 years old has been working with kids, okay. Whether it was a camp counselor. In my 20s, I end up spending time working in the foster care system. And then I ended up spending some time teaching, specifically middle school. And that was a real adventure. I walked into my first year of teaching thinking, oh, I'm going to be a great teacher. Like, this is going to be awesome. Like, the kids are going to love me. They're going to listen to me. They're going to put apples on my desk. And it's going to be, you know, some just magical learning experience. Not so much. I got it handed to me by those middle schoolers, but I did learn and I grow. And in the years that followed from my first year, I got better at my craft of teaching. And I was also coaching high school sports at the time. Okay. I coached tennis, basketball, and baseball. Still play a lot of sports and like being active each day. But I learned even in that high school, middle school, I was like, man, you know, I really would find value in teaching younger kids, because by the time I got some of these kids in high school and middle school, like, they were really missing some gaps. There was some real developmental delays socially as well as academically. And so I then spent a big chunk of my life working at a nonprofit called Go For It, which was basically a train-the-trainer model. And so we were working and training on a program that was life skills-based for children in elementary and ECE environments. And every step of the way, I kept saying to myself, man, I just want to get them younger. Because the younger you get kids, in my opinion, the better chance they have for success down the road. And there's a couple kind of stats to think about is that in at least the United States, third grade is kind of the watermark for reading. And up to third grade, you are learning how to read.
Right.
After third grade, you read to learn. So again, up till third grade, you're learning the phonics of reading. You're learning structure. After that, you're learning about history. You're learning about math, the world. It's no longer the idea of learning to read. And so for so many kids that aren't able to read by the age of third grade, they are just missing out on, they're always playing catch up. And so even at that point, I dove down even younger, and they say that between 80 and 90% of all the hard wiring in the brain is complete by the age of three. Not third grade, but the age of three. And so it's this idea that those first 3 years are, and there's nobody's going to argue with me otherwise, that those are the most informative, life-altering years of your life as far as, you know, putting the infrastructure, the literal infrastructure of synapses and hardwiring into your brain so that you can succeed later in life. And kind of with that idea in mind, as you mentioned, in 2017, my wife and I opened a preschool, and that's where we are today. We've been running it ever since. And as the school grew and started to have success, and that's where you'd mentioned that kind of that opening bio piece was that I realized the importance of early child. I got really not just intellectual theory, but I saw it on a day-to-day basis, and I wanted to commit myself not only to my school and the families that I work with and the students that I serve, but that wanted to roll this out on a legislative, legal level on statewide and within my city and my community so that everybody has access to it, that children and families who, A, can't afford it, or two, just don't understand the importance of it, can get access. So,
I mean, you're talking about all these lovely intersections around neuroscience and literacy, and I mean, I totally get it what you're saying as well. I mean, I've got a 6 year old, and I can already see, you know, how much in terms of learning, development, comprehension is already there compared to like when I was his age. You know, so things have clearly changed, and I mean, it sounds wonderful in terms of what you're doing. And I can hear the passion behind it as well. So this is where you're really making an impact. And, you know, David, the one thing I want you to talk a little bit about, because you said it was life-altering. And I love that you've come to my part of the world. So you came to South Africa and you spent some time in Guguletu in Cape Town. I'd love to know a little bit more about that. How did that impact you?
Sure. So I love South Africa. It will always have a place in my heart. Because I would say that that opportunity was one of the life-defining, one of those moments that I clearly remember changing my trajectory.
Okay.
And I think it's actually a lot of how I ended up in education. So this was in my college years, university years.
All right.
I was lucky enough and had the opportunity to spend almost half a year studying abroad in South Africa in general. But the focal area was that I spent the most time was in and around Cape Town. And Cape Town is a beautiful world-class city. And one of the unique things that I kind of found is South Africa has an intersection between extreme poverty and extreme wealth. And it really challenged me on a very personal level, my beliefs, my experiences, because you mentioned Guguletu. And for those who don't know what that is, it is a township about 35 minutes outside of the center of Cape Town. There's about, I don't know the exact number, but roughly about 100,000 people, almost entirely African-American community. And my friend and I lived in Guguletu, and we were the only white people out of a township of only almost 100,000 people. I stayed with a family for a bunch of months. My host father was a school bus driver. My host mother was a teacher in one of the schools. And I spent time in the schools, both in Guguletu and throughout South Africa. And I was blown away by the joy that the kids had for going to school. I can't speak for around the world, but there is a situation in many schools in the United States where school isn't fun. It's looked at as a chore. It's looked at as something that you have to do, that it's not a blessed opportunity. That, like, with education is one of the great levelers we have on earth across all countries, ethnicities, race.
Yeah.
With education, you have power, you can make choices, and to take that for granted, which large portions of our country can, not everybody, but large portions, we have great schools with great wealth to support these schools. Yeah. And I went to some of the schools in South Africa, in that township in particular, and the resources that they had are, you know, 1/1,000,000,000th the fraction of a school that we have in some parts of the United States. And I saw these kids and the teachers loving it. They loved every bit of it. They were laughing. They were excited to learn. I'd come in and do what best lesson plan I could to work with the kids. And they loved every bit of it. And I had a real aha moment of, you know, if these kids in this, you know, situation can find this much joy in their education, what is it that's preventing some students in the community that I live in from having that same love of learning? And I kind of vowed that I was going to take that lesson and bring it back. And subconsciously or not, that may be kind of one of the main reasons why I have always stayed in that education realm or industry.
Okay. I mean, I can just hear it in your voice as well. You know, as you're relaying it, like that impact around it really, really sort of resonated. And then, yeah, obviously, maybe it has played a part in terms of then your sort of mission in the space to actually bring that joy and bring that creativity in early childhood development as well. Brilliant. And I mean, you're doing it alongside one of the greatest partnerships ever, it sounds like, in terms of you and Addison. And I want to know more about that, because we are talking partnerships, right? Share some of that experience of, you know, this beautiful partnership, this marriage, this relationship that you have together, and how it's actually making such beautiful impact, not only at home, but also with the school as well, David.
As you mentioned, in preparation, you asked the question, like, what are some of the most life-defining moments of your life?
Yeah.
And it popped up quite naturally. And I did ask my wife without, you know, rigging the question, what she would say. And I'm happy to report that she also said the most important, best thing, greatest accomplishment either of us have had in our entire lives is the marriage we have with each other and meeting each other.
That's beautiful. Yes, that's beautiful.
And it was a pretty, like, you know, she had been married before, she had a beautiful stepson. And I basically spent, as far as date, I'm no date expert, but I did date a lot in my 20s. One of my big things was that I just wasn't ready for commitment at that time. That's fine. But then starting in my 30s, I started to enter into what I call the playing out version of dating. Which I was starting to think, you know, I actually think that I might be ready to kind of make that commitment and also start a family. And so in my 30s, I was starting to date a little bit more with, you know, I'd go on a date and on the first date, I'd ask, do you want to have kids? Do you want to have more kids?
Oh, married. Pretty serious questions.
Yeah. So I was getting a little bit more serious at the time. You know, I'd been on a series even in my 30s of relationships that, you know, were great relationships with beautiful and smart women, but just never fully clicked. And so I was in a space where I actually wasn't looking for a relationship. And oftentimes that's exactly when you find a relationship. And so I actually met my wife at a Broncos tailgate, which, for those of you who don't know, is the big sports team, American football sports team in my home state of Colorado. And we met on a Sunday and went on two dates, and the following, you know, it was basically a blind date that kind of connected the whole piece of it. But we were pretty much dating a week later, And we never looked back. And so ever since that encounter, that chance, if not fate-based encounter, we have fallen in love. We ended up having two additional boys. So I got a full family of three boys. There's a big gamut of boys in our house.
Weird.
And then it was like the second date. And I said, what do you want to do for a career? And she said, she was in corporate America at the time.
Right.
And she said, I have this idea of opening a preschool. And I said, that's it. Mm-hmm. I want to run my own business, but I want to stay in education and work with younger kids.
Right.
And so I actually, this whole preschool is, I stole her dream and I said, okay, I'm going to do it. And so, we signed the paperwork to begin the process to buy the land and the business 2 weeks before we got married. And so we went all in quite quickly. And 8, 9, 10 years later, here we are. And we're literally in the same building. We drive to work most days.
Yeah.
I see her all the time. And she jokes that we're still as much in love today as we were when we met. So I feel very lucky about that.
Oh, no. I mean, it sounds phenomenal and beautiful. I mean, to be able to, and even just when you're recounting, you know, when you actually first met and that whole beginning piece, it's so vivid and fresh in your mind, like it was yesterday. That's beautiful. And, you know, as you're saying, this is something that both of you feel is one of the best things that you've done in your life. And it sounds like such a beautiful, you know, even beyond marriage, it's a real, real partnership of minds, of hearts, of everything. And I guess you're probably the right person for me to ask this question of, then what is the key to successful partnership and marriage then, in your opinion, David?
Glad that you do clarify partnership. Marriage is what she and I have, but partnership is also what we are. It's partnership comes in so many forms in life and how you define a relationship with somebody. Yeah. But my advice is, I guess that I kind of break it down to like three main things.
Okay.
And this is advice I would give myself. There were so many times in my 20s and 30s when I was dating and it was a struggle and it wasn't painful, but like there was anxiety around the relationship. Is this the one? Is she not the one? Like, does she really like me? Does she not like me? You know, all the insecurities that pop
up.
And my single greatest piece of advice for anybody, especially early on in their relationship, is to have this deep belief, and it's not an easy belief to always, you know, believe or cultivate, but it really doesn't have to be that hard. Mm-hmm. That it shouldn't be some struggle of trying to make the pieces work and, you know, is this a good fit or not?
Right.
I had all of these, you know, issues or belief systems leading up to when I met her. And the best thing, and this is why I think we fell in love so quickly, was for our partnership, it was easy. Mm-hmm. It can be easy. And it was never this easy for me. And only once, and this is hindsight where you have it, only once I actually was able to feel it and realize how easy it was,
right,
could I then say, man, I should have done things so much differently in the past, because I now realize, you know, what it can be. Now, keep in mind, and my wife and I talk about this all the time, that a lot of those ex-relationships, partnerships, they taught us lessons that got me and I to the same place at the same time in the right mindset. So, but the other, you know, kind of tidbit I would add, and this came directly from our relationship, is accept the person for who they are and don't expect them to change. If there was a person, if a person changes, great. If they change for the better, great. If they change for the worse, that is what it is. But there was, when I met her, I was a humongous closet smoker where I was, and I was a healthy person. I mean, I was, nobody had any idea, but I would like leave a party and I'd run, you know, and I, or a gathering, and I'd go smoke a cigarette, and nobody really knew, except for my wife did, because I, you know, or at the time Allison did, because we were dating, and at one point I was living with her.
Right.
And I said, I will not be a smoking husband. I will not be a smoking father. And she said, I know, I believe you. And she never was like beat on me. She never, you know, chastised me, belittled me. She believed that who I was enough. And she believed that if it was going to happen, I was going to make that change. And she did that on so many different fronts of just accepting me for who I am. But I will add a little anecdote, which is the last cigarette I had was the morning of the day I married my wife, Allison. Oh. I had committed that I was never going to be a smoking husband.
Yeah.
And on that day, I had one in the morning. She was at the hotel. She was getting ready. I had the last smoke of my life. And then I went and married her at the altar and said, well, that's the end of that.
Okay.
And it held. And it held. So
that
I was lucky.
That's such a beautiful sort of trust. And that's what I'm hearing, you know, from Allison to you. I mean, the fact that you said, you know, I this is not who I wanted to be. And she just trusted that and said, okay, you know, you do that. And you actually then deliberately did it on this beautiful moment of your wedding day, just before you took your vows and all of that work. Oh, that's lovely. So I love those pieces of advice, David. And
I would add that.
Yeah.
Oh, RJ, I was just going to say that this partnership, that advice should go beyond just relationships. This can be a work relationship. Accepting people for who they are.
Yes.
And still loving them. If they change, great. But we have so much energy that we expect them to do something. And when they don't do it, it sets this, you know, this false expectation. And then there's disappointment. Accepting people for who they are, doing the best they can with the tools they have, is a really great mindset in general, but particularly true when dealing with your, intimate partnerships that, whether it's marriage or otherwise.
Of course, of course. I think that is such a great foundation with which to look at any kind of relationship, any kind of partnership, business, personal. The fact that each one can be on their own level, but kind of then melding together for a particular purpose. On that basis, I think it just sets a really, really good place to work from, you know, without having all these alternative expectations. It releases the baggage, let's put it that way. So I love that. And then, you know, okay, so let's bring in the parenting component now with the partnership, right? So, you know, you and your wife, Allison, you work with kids, young kids every day. You're in this beautiful partnership together, in marriage, in business as well. So, David, how do you think marriage and partnership then actually impacts raising of kids, be it your own, be it through the school that you're running as well? What do you think?
Really good question, Artie. I guess when I think about that question, it's I do have a front row seat to all kinds of parents, both in the school and with my kids and their parents and their sports. And I have a kid who's in high school, or he's 15 years old. And I see it with his friends as well, that I deeply believe that what makes happy kids is happy parents. And it ultimately comes down to modeling. Parents get so focused on which school I should send my child to, or what job they should have, or, you know, what sports team or which book should they read? They focus on a lot of things about what they want for their child.
Right.
When in reality, one of the biggest things they should be doing is putting a mirror on themselves and look at their life and their partnerships, their career, their health. And if you are living a happy life, if you and a partner in particular, and you're raising children, if you two have a happy marriage, if you talk to each other, your partner with respect, if you show them love, if you show them that sometimes you disagree, but that you have a way to process those things, kids will absorb that, and they will take that and they will start to model that with other experiences that they have in life. And I will add that I'm also a firm believer of nature and nurture. So it's not all about parenting. I firmly believe that you have two parents or two partners that raise two children, the same household under the same modeling principles, and one child functions completely different than the other child. And you, as parents who have had multiple children, know what I mean by that. When you're like, where did you come from? Like, you are nothing like your other child, and you are certainly nothing like your mother or I. And it doesn't mean, modeling doesn't mean that they like you, look like you, talk like you. Modeling is a basic empathy. It's a basic understanding of being human. And if you can live that, and I see this all the time with kids, with, again, these parents, there are parents who project their own fears, insecurities, and it doesn't always equal this, but the kids who have a harder time transitioning in the school or have a harder time with various aspects of growing up, you can often connect it to a parent or a situation that they're experiencing at home. And what I want for parents is for them to trust the world for their child. I want them to let their child take risks. Let your child fail. Failure is a really good thing, especially younger in their younger years, so they can learn how to adapt, how to create skills and tools that will help them succeed. But so many parents are trying to move obstacles out of the way. They're trying to prevent their child from feeling any pain. Yeah. And in doing so, they think they're really trying to help their child. But in the end, they're preventing their child from kind of growing and building those skills. And as I said, backing it up to role modeling, is are you living the same things you want for your kid? Mm-hmm. Are you taking risks as parents? Are you allowing yourself or your partner to fail? Yeah. Are you trusting the world? Are you showing your child the world is good? Yes, there's so much chaos right now. This is a crazy time we're living in. But if we live in a space where the world is bad, then our kids are going to absorb that as well. If we come from the space that the world is not perfect, but I trust it, I trust that this world can still provide for myself and my family and my community and my friends, that will create a sense of safety for kids so that they can live life, so they can, you know, make their mark on the world.
All right. You know, and that's bringing so much up for me as well, because, you know, in my work as a coach, I see this playing out in terms of the adult who's now in front of me in a coaching session, you know, and when we deep diving, it's because of things that have happened in childhood. It's things that they've seen in the home, in their cultural sort of context as well, David. So I completely get what you're saying, that, you know, they are listening, absorbing, watching, modeling whatever is going on around them. And when you don't have that ability to cope with stressful situations or to cope with difficult things and be able to build your resilience over time, it definitely plays out in adulthood as well. So yeah, that was just coming up for me really, really strongly when you were talking about this in particular. So maybe, you know, one thing, maybe you've given us some really good ideas about risk taking and learning from failure and all of that. What is probably the one key piece of advice you probably want to share with parents about some of the things that they really need to be focusing on, you know, when working with kids, and basically how can they really be present for their kids in a way that allows the kids to show up well for themselves too? I mean, because as you said, they're learning in their environment, but they're also taking in what's going on with the parents. What is something that you could offer parents in terms of?
There's a lot there. I guess there's many tips I would love to give to give parents, but I'd have to go back to that original comment, which is happy parents make for happy kids. And so if you are in a marriage or partnership that's not working and you know it, you've got to do one of two things. Mm-hmm. You either have to make a change, and that change is like do things differently in your marriage, or you need to get out. Or you know, create some separation. Life is too short to be in this space of I have to stay in this relationship because there is no exact path. Like you being miserable in a relationship is not going to help your child. You being having the courage to make a change in the relationship, and that can be dealing with in a relationship addiction or you know, substance abuse or things that doesn't mean that you don't like the person,
right?
But you need to be willing to say to your partner or say to your husband or wife that what they are doing, that they are working too much, they're on their phone too much, it is not working, and it is affecting you and it's affecting me, and ultimately then is going to affect the child. So it's the reverse of work on yourself first, and then there's that the classic metaphor of you're in an airplane. And then when the plane's in turbulence, the mask drops down and they say, put it on you first so that you can support your child. And I think that's a good way of looking at it. You got to make sure that you're right. Make sure your relationship and your partnership is right. Yeah. And then you'll be in the space to really genuinely support your child. And I know there's a lot of nuance in what that looks like. We need to be there for our kids. And sometimes you just have to make it work for reasons of safety and security. I understand. You are in a place where you have the ability to make that change, have that courage so that you are living and modeling a happy, fulfilled life so that your kids have that as something to look up to.
Lovely. I love that. David, we've been having such a beautiful conversation. There's so many different avenues we can continue talking about. But I think, you know, as we're coming to the end, maybe just give our listeners a quick view on, well, what's in store next for you, for Allison, for your work in early childhood education. What's coming up for the evening?
So the next is you know, we just expanded the school again. And so we're not going to expand anymore. We're going to let that be. And we're going to spend more time again on the kind of the political and the legal aspect of creating early childhood education that works for all and not have it get lost in bureaucracy. And so we're going to continue to involve ourselves on a state and local level to help specifically the children of Colorado have access to great care. So it's a big project. It's slow moving with all things political. Two steps forward, one and a half steps back, but too important not to care. Much is given, much is required.
Wishing you success on your mission with that. Absolutely. It's definitely worthwhile and important. David, as we're ending off, I'd love it if you could share something that's quite inspirational for you, maybe even personal for you and your wife, that really just keeps you motivated and inspired to, you know, have a wonderful marriage and partnership together to do the work that you're doing. What stands out for you? It could be a lyric, a quote, something spiritual, whatever you prefer.
My favorite quote still comes from Gandhi, which is that idea or the be the change you wish to see in the world. Don't just sit on the sideline. If something's not working, don't complain about it. Be somebody who's willing to be the change you want to see in the world.
Okay. That's, I mean, it's always been a simple yet profound, I think, quote that everyone should be looking to incorporate in their life. And I think it stands true for even today, even more so, I think, today. David, thank you so much. It's been such a pleasure having you on the episode today. Wishing you success and everything of the best.
Artie, you're the best. Thanks so much for having me.
Thank you, David. Take care.
Bye-bye.
Thank you so much for joining me on this episode today. If you like what you heard, rate the episode and podcast, and feel free to write a review. Plus, of course, share with others too. I love talking around topics like these. So if you like my perspective or insight on a subject close to your heart, or something that you're grappling with, reach out to me in your comments or send me an email via my website or connect with me via LinkedIn, Instagram, or Facebook. All my social media are on the podcast information. If it's important to you, then it's important to me. So happy listening to the Inspire Your Life podcast, and catch you soon on the next episode. Bye.